At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Obama's inviting Republicans over to watch the Super Bowl at the White House this weekend. But don't expect peace, love, and the passage of a raft of bills to break out Monday morning. At a time when the United States is facing historic challenges, giant problems, Congress can feel like the place solutions go to die. It's been called the broken branch of American government. Is it more broken now? This hour, On Point, a time of challenge, some say crisis, is with us. What's going on with Congress? You can join the conversation. What do you see on Capitol Hill? Money politics? Partisan deathmatch? Paralysis? The American way? Can Congress step up to this country's problems? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Thomas Mann, congressional scholar, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. In 2006, he co-authored with Norm Ornstein, The Broken Branch, How Congress is Failing America and How to Get It Back on Track. Thomas Mann, thanks very much for being with us.
Tom, very happy to be with you again.
And from Williamsburg, Virginia, we are joined by Larry Evans, congressional scholar at the College of William and Mary. In the early 90s, he worked in the office of Representative Lee Hamilton of Indiana on a bipartisan congressional reform committee. He's writing a book on party leadership on Capitol Hill. Larry Evans, thank you very much for being here.
Oh, thanks very much. It's my pleasure.
Okay, Thomas Mann, help us here. We're just trying to figure out what's going on. Some say, well, it's just the American way. The Democrats have an agenda. The Republicans don't like it. They're doing everything they can to stop it. So it's not moving. And if that's the way it is, that's just the way it is. That's what this country does. On the other hand, a lot of people are saying we are really at a crossroads here. The fate of the nation is kind of hanging in the balance. And right across the horizon, from energy to education to health care to banking, you name it, we're not getting enough action out of Congress. And it's not funny anymore. How do you see what's going on here, Tom?
Well, as you might expect, there's a bit of truth in both perspectives. On the one hand, there have really been substantial accomplishments in this Congress. The public doesn't like to recognize it, but within a month they passed a major stimulus bill coordinated with the G20 that together helped avert a global depression. That ain't bad. And since then, they have passed 15-20 pieces of not insignificant legislation. And they are in the midst of and may still pass major health reform, the likes of which we haven't seen in major decades, a reform of the financial system, major education reform, and not cap and trade now, but some energy legislation. And so, listen, let's catch our breath. It's not all falling to pieces. On the other hand, the problems that led Norm Ornstein and me to write our book about Congress's problems, the ideological polarization of the parties and rough parity between the two, meaning you could have a change in majority party control of the House and Senate and of the White House, has produced parliamentary-like parties, extraordinary internal unity, but they're operating in the congressional system, which in our case includes this supermajority hurdle in the Senate because of the filibuster. with the Republicans' decision to just oppose and that supermajority hurdle and party unity, we've had a lot of very divisive, difficult, indeed obstructive politics, and it doesn't look too good.
Larry Evans, here's I mean, you could turn almost anywhere and find something like this, but just to put a stick in here, Tom Friedman, the New York Times columnist, went to Davos, Switzerland, talked with people there, and, you know, came out saying this country is making the whole world nervous by not getting on top of problems that look so urgent. He ended up writing out of there, if the two parties could get together and remove the clouds of uncertainty over this whole raft of issues, we know the list, remove the growing sense that this country is politically paralyzed, you would not need another dime of stimulus money. Investment and lending would just take off on their own. But he wrote, if the two parties continue their duel to the death paralysis, no amount of stimulus will give us the sustained growth and employment we need. What's going on, in your view, in Congress, Larry?
Well, I agree mostly with what Tom said, but there are some serious legislative challenges that have gone unmet, and it doesn't look like there's going to be much progress in the near term, particularly with climate change and with the deficit. And I think that the individuals that were quoted by Mr. Friedman were responding to those kinds of concerns. I mean, the problem really is that there's not much of a middle ground anymore on Capitol Hill. There's very little overlap between the parties. There's a real center to public opinion out there in the country, but that middle doesn't really rule in Congress because there are so few moderate conservative Democrats now and liberal Republicans. There has been a lot of filibustering and a lot of threatened filibusters and obstructionism in the Senate. In part, though, that's simply because without resorting to those kinds of tactics, the Republicans are pretty sure that the Democratic majority in the Senate would not listen to them at all. And I do think there's something to that.
Let's look at polarization. There's a whole list of things to go down here from the media and leadership and you name it. But polarization first. Thomas Mann calls that a kind of going parliamentary style of American Congress, but without parliamentary style rules that might allow things to still roll forward. It's a huge question. Maybe it goes to redistricting. Maybe it goes to the media. You tell us. But if you look back in history, have we not seen polarization like this in the past? Is this all new? Is this, you know, is this enough to paralyze the government that's supposed to deal with our problems?
Well, there's been polarization has been and pretty standard in American politics until the mid part of the 20th century. If you go before that, look before that, the parties were polarized, and of course they're polarized now. And so, in a sense, the period around the 1950s and 1960s is the unusual one. But for a variety of reasons, you mentioned some of them, there has been an increased polarization, even though we don't see this polarization out there in the electorate. The polarization is in Congress. It's in Washington. I don't think it's redistricting because we see the polarization equally on the Senate side and the Senate, you know,
super state period. You don't think it's redistricting? Thomas Mann, what do you point to? There's a media surround. There's a lot going on here. Larry Evans says there's a center in the country that's not represented in the Congress. I don't know if that's true anymore.
I don't agree with Larry on that point. It's true the public is less political and less sort of clearly ideological, but what has started all of this was actually in the electorate. It was a regional realignment of the political parties, beginning with the counterculture of the 60s, the Voting Rights Act, Roe versus Wade, Prop 13 in California. The fact is that the public has sorted itself into political parties based on their rough sense of ideology. There are now, in poll after poll, clear signs of people who identify as Republicans seeing the world fundamentally different from those who identify themselves as Democrats. And that finds its way into the political process here in Washington, reinforced by news sources that attract only like-minded people, by interest groups that associate themselves only with one political party and try to impose a kind of purity of thought right now. Yes, we've had polarization in the past, especially around the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, but back then, for the most part, majorities still ruled. if we didn't have the routinization of the filibuster in the Senate today, and that is a new phenomenon. Mm-hmm. We've been moving toward that since the early 70s, but it's really taken off. More of President Obama's program would be enacted into law. What other democracy around the world could address its problems having to have super majorities when those are seldom actually achieved by one political party?
Larry Evans, do you see the use of the filibuster in the Senate as a core problem here? There's something like 10 times as many filibuster threats coming up these days, we hear. Is that fundamentally changed, and why?
Well, it is the case that the use of threatened filibusters and filibusters has ramped up. There's no doubt about that since the 1970s, and it's taken on an increasingly partisan cast. But I mean, the filibuster is best viewed as part of the bargaining process that occurs on Capitol Hill. You know, it's not unusual for bills that have been subject to a threatened filibuster to lead to a certain amount of bargaining across the aisle, which gets the filibuster essentially defeated in the long term. The filibuster, to me, though, is largely an institutional manifestation of this broader sorting out that Tom refers to of the two parties, where the Democrats become the party of the ideological liberals, Republicans of ideological conservatives. It is the case that we've seen the sorting in the electorate as well with the Voting Rights Act and in the decades that followed. But still, most Americans on surveys do tend to articulate centrist viewpoints. They're not the ones that matter, though, in the electoral process. It tends to be more the activist base, the people who are associated closely with one party or the other.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Congress and the sense that the country is paralyzed when it needs to be moving and changing. Thomas Mann joins us this hour. He's co-author of The Broken Branch. He joins us from Washington. Larry Evans is here from the College of William and Mary. Republicans say we're just sticking up for what we believe in. On Meet the Press last Sunday, House Minority Leader Republican John Boehner of Ohio said the reason the country doesn't have health care reform is that Democrats are scheming. Republicans are just listening to American voters, showing good and proper vigilance on their behalf.
We've seen all week Speaker Pelosi, Majority Leader Reid, continuing to scheme and plot, trying to find some way to get their big government takeover of health care enacted. And so I do think they're having problems, but I think Republicans are going to continue to be vigilant in exposing this. And I think the American people need to stay engaged, because I'm watching all of the movement on the Hill. They're still trying to find a way, even after Massachusetts, the election there, they're still trying to find a way to shove this down the throat to the American people. And the American people are saying, no, stop. And what we need to do is scrap the big government takeover bill and let's start over.
Thomas Mann, Larry Evans, there's John Boehner's GOP explanation for one element of what's going on here. On the other hand, let's listen for just a moment. Here's the president. This is in New Hampshire yesterday, Nashua, New Hampshire. Looking on the deficit front, he said partisanship on Capitol Hill has gone to absurd extremes. And he gave this example of a Senate proposal to create a bipartisan commission to fix the deficit.
This law failed by 7 votes. When 7 Republicans who had co-sponsored the bill, had co-sponsored the idea, suddenly walked away from their own proposal after I endorsed it. So they make a proposal, they sign on to the bill, I say, great, good idea. I turn around, they're gone. What happened? Now, look, it's one thing to have an honest difference of opinion on something. There's nothing wrong with that. But you can't walk away from your responsibilities to confront the challenges facing the country because you don't think it's good short-term politics. We can't afford that.
President Obama yesterday pushing back. Larry Evans, what do you see going on here? Republicans standing on principle, fighting against something they can't believe in and don't support? Or straight-up politics at a time when we clearly need changes in this country?
Well, I'm to some extent listening to the two statements. There's something to both of them. Mr. Boehner is correct that the Republicans have largely been left out of negotiations over health care reform and the House of Representatives. But the president is absolutely right that that there are some very surprising shifts in position on this proposed deficit reduction commission, where the Republicans, who would be guaranteed parity in membership on this panel, which they certainly don't have in the House or Senate, have turned on it because they thought that this commission might provide the president with some political cover on the deficit. So in a sense, they both are right.
Thomas Mann, we expect politics in this country. It's a democracy. But is there such a thing as politics getting out of hand, or as you put it, becoming a kind of parliamentary system in a structure that's not meant for that approach?
Yes, I'm going to have to take issue with Larry on this one. It's our natural instinct as scholars, as journalists, is to say, oh, a pox on both their houses. They're equally to blame. I listened to those two segments, and I heard John Boehner's sort of campaign lines, a big government takeover of health reform system. Now, the fact is, the bill that we have that the Democrats have put together looks an awful lot like the Republican alternative offered by Senator Chafee and others in 1994. It bends over backwards not to upset the private health insurance system, but works around the edges to try to get extended coverage through mandates on individuals and subsidies and to begin to get control of cost. There was an alternative bill, the Bennett-Wyden bill, another approach but equally ambitious that had attracted seven Republican co-sponsors, all of whom abandoned that bill early on because the word was out in the Republican Party, we are going to kill health reform because if it passes, Democrats are going to be sitting pretty politically. Republicans had every opportunity in markups and committee in the House, certainly in those extended negotiations over the months of the summer out of the Senate Finance Committee, if they would have taken the goals that the president has, which is to move toward universal coverage while constraining cost. They could have had a big impact on this bill, but they made a decision to opt out. And frankly, what's happened now is that for some members, some pragmatic members of the House and the Senate, they no longer feel free to act on their policy beliefs. There's so much pressure within the party caucus to hold the line. And in this case, since the Democrats have won two substantial elections in a row, any notion of Democratic accountability would say you begin with a Democratic president's campaign promise and then negotiate. But there's no one to negotiate with on the Republican side, and there's a supermajority hurdle in the Senate. And so the only way you can try to move forward on these issues is to try to keep your own party together. That leads you into the kind of unattractive bargaining with Senator Ben Nelson and special benefits, but there's no alternative to it. So I do think there's a problem here, and when the Republicans make arguments like they're making, to recognize them as having very little in the way of substance and transparently political, part of the permanent campaign.
We've got listeners on the one hand saying here that they're all for obstructionism rather than legislative proposals being promoted in this Congress, and others asking, here's Jeff asking at the website, you know, my question is, when do we call what is happening in D.C. a constitutional crisis? Let's go to Mary in Iowa. And Brian, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I remember in Ronald Reagan's first campaign, his making the statement that government wasn't the solution to the problem, government was the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if the subsequent years of perhaps both parties to some extent decrying their own function, leading into Congress becoming more or less dysfunctional. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Brian. Larry Evans, what do you say? I don't know if Ronald Reagan was right or wrong, but you know, it sure looks right now like there's problems in that quarter. What do you say to Brian?
Well, in terms of government being the problem, I mean, there's no way that we can rely on the private sector to kind of work our way out of this crisis in healthcare because the government is so involved, so much involved with in terms of Medicare and Medicaid. The pressing problem we have with the deficit is largely a problem of healthcare costs. And I think that, you know, Mr. Boehner and the Republicans are correct that the current legislation focuses more on extending insurance coverage than it does on dealing with this underlying problem.
But when there was talk about cutting back on Medicare, they went after that hammer and tongs. That would be cost cutting.
No, absolutely. I mean, that would be cost cutting and be unpopular, but it's the sort of step that is going to have to be taken long term if we're to confront the underlying problem with a deficit.
But maybe Congress can't do that. Let's look for a second at this idea of a constitutional crisis or the supermajority, the 60-vote piece in the Senate. That's grown over a long time. Times when Republicans had a majority, now times when the Democrats had a majority, it's grown a lot, the Republican use of it. But can you see, you know, if we've become, in fact, a different kind of polity here, a more parliamentary kind of profile on Capitol Hill, do we need to reconsider that 60-vote to supermajority requirement? First, Larry.
Well, absolutely, we should consider it. But again, I would emphasize that there would be little incentive in a democratically or a republicanly controlled Senate to legislate across the aisle without the filibuster. The Senate would look a lot like the House, and in the House during health care reform, the minority party really didn't play much of a role. It was largely drafted on the Democratic side of the aisle.
So, Thomas Mann, is there something to be done there, or is that just, you know, what we've got, and that's the way it is?
No, I don't think we should just accept it. In fact, the sort of scholarly notion of the filibuster, the supermajority hurdle, the 60-vote pivot point, encouraging bargaining and centrist policies has given way to something very different. It has not been the record in recent times. It does two things. One, it empowers individual senators with their holes to on both sides of the aisle to kind of advance their own sort of personal particularistic interest that oftentimes have nothing to do with the underlying bill. And secondly, it's a vehicle in many cases for a complete irresolution of problems that we confront. It wasn't provided for in the Constitution. It was seldom used through most of our history. It used to require someone actually holding the floor.
Everett Dirksen reading from the phone book.
Exactly, until it could be stopped. The possibility of its extended use was created by Majority Leader Mike Mansfield when he set up a two-track system because there were so many demands of holes by members. He wanted to get some business done, and now we have its routinization. It is really undemocratic. It was not anticipated by the framers, and the problem is, Larry's right, it's hard to change because members, even in the majority, frustrated now, don't want to give up the power of the individual hold, and they worry that once they go in the minority, they wouldn't have a tool to obstruct. I think the only way to deal with it now is the way President Obama is doing. He's offering a hand, but he's calling the Republicans when they're simply obstructing. And I think over time he's going to ask the question, why doesn't majority rule in the Senate, and try to, in effect, use shame so as to get the minority to see that they will be harmed rather than helped politically if they continue to avoid genuine bargaining and use it simply as a method of obstruction.
So there's a rhetorical response to it. But Larry Evans, would there be some way, advisable way, to trim the sails of the filibuster without cutting the minority, whoever that would be, out of the process?
Well, I mean, there were steps in that direction earlier on in the last decade over President Bush's judicial nominations. There was discussion of employing a so-called nuclear option. The Republicans considered doing that, where they essentially would use procedural techniques to overturn the use of the filibuster on those nominations. You could imagine something like that occurring again. I don't think we're there yet for the reasons that Tom Mann mentioned, that Democrats, a lot of Democrats in their heart of hearts, kind of like a filibuster because they can use holds and threaten obstructionism to get benefits for their states.
Let's go to our listeners. Brad in Boston. Brad, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling simply with a comment, and that is, as everyone is discussing, the two parties have become so solidified behind their respective bases that it is impossible to pass compromise legislation that's going to move things forward. And I think being in Boston, one of the things we have taken from Scott Brown's election is someone that just might be somewhat more independent thinking, that move things ahead. What everyone should take out of this, your guests and our legislatures, is we need some compromise legislation that will move our country forward. I'll take my answer off the air.
Brad, thank you for your call. Tom Mann, how do you see it? Will voters eventually seek out centrist candidates to solve this? Is that the solution, or is there something else that needs to go on here to break the logjam? Brad wants compromise.
Yeah, it'll be fascinating to watch new Senator Brown in this environment, because we also have Olympia Snow and Susan Collins, moderate Republicans from the Northeast, and yet both joined their party on health care. They were willing to join the Democrats on the original stimulus bill. Each extracted some changes that served their own individual interest in doing so. But the pressure on Brown is going to be enormous, and he's already said he would provide the 41st vote to kill health reform, and the proposals that are coming from the Republican Party would in effect completely reverse the whole direction and goals of health reform. So maybe over time this could help, but Tom, I know this is very politically incorrect to say, but the public is actually at root of some of the problems that we have here. Take the stimulus. They now are understandably scared. We've got high unemployment. Mm. I just absolutely sympathize with the problems, but they're now arguing we need to. The stimulus was a terrible mistake. We shouldn't have done it. We ought to.
When you say they, who's they there, Tom?
The public. Mm-hmm. That the government should cut back like households are doing. Well, Economics 101 says government has to be countercyclical or will spiral into a depression. So we need clearer education coming from politicians and a public willing to spend a little time to listen and read and think through some of these problems.
Larry, but that's not what people feel like they're getting, and it's not what we seem to be producing election after election lately. Yet the country stares at the problems that the country's got in front of it, and it just doesn't feel like we can sit here in this lockup, in this paralysis.
Well, as Tom Mann mentioned, we haven't really had paralysis over the past year. There's actually been a lot of very significant enactments and, a really almost unprecedented expansion of the role of the federal government in the economy. So gridlock doesn't really capture what's happening. The process, though, is very, very messy and very, very partisan. In terms of health care reform, though, if we are going to see any reaching across the aisle in the Senate anyway, it's going to have to be toward Olympia Snow and perhaps Susan Collins. And that is going to be made possible by the fact of the filibuster. Absent that filibuster, Senator Reid would be able to pass legislation just with Democratic votes.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this about Congress in the sense that the country is facing great, big, urgent issues that are not being addressed. Thomas Mann joins us from Washington, the Brookings Institute. He's co-author of The Broken Branch. Larry Evans is with us from the College of William and Mary. He's working on a book right now on the on party leadership on Capitol Hill, maybe called The Whip Systems of Congress. President Obama, famously, at the Republican retreat last week in Baltimore, he looked out on the crowd, saw Republican pollster Frank Luntz there, who's done a lot of issue shaping for the GOP, and singled him out, suggested that he and maybe even his presence at the event is part of the problem.
Every time somebody speaks in Congress, the first thing they do, they stand up and all the talking points. You know, I see Frank Luntz up here sitting in the front. He's already polled it, and he said, you know, the way you're really going to, I've done a focus group, and, you know, the way we're going to really box in Obama on this one or make Pelosi look bad on that one. I know, I like Frank. We've had conversations between Frank and I, but that's how we operate. It's all tactics. And it's not solving problems.
So says the president. Of course, he's got his agenda to push here. Let's get a call from Buffalo, New York. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you think, Chris?
You're aggravating me, Tom.
Okay, let's hear it.
We're fighting for our country. Obama and the Democrats want to take this country in a direction that we don't want to go. Those are out here in flyover country. We don't want to go where he wants to take it.
And so what does that mean? Fight everything sort of to the death? Are you worried at all about a paralysis in that may leave us vulnerable to big problems?
If that's the way it has to be, but it's better than going in the direction that the Democrats and Obama and Pelosi and Reid want to take us, no. Absolutely flat out, no.
Straight up no, Tom?
Well, I think Chris's comments help explain how the public fits into this. This is just not a Washington problem.
Mm-hmm.
She feels very strongly about her views, and listen, Obama and the Democrats won the election. In a democracy, the idea is that majorities rule. Of course, in our system, you know, there is bargaining that occurs if people are willing to bargaining. But Chris's worldview is so fundamentally different from that of the president who won and the Democrats who won.
But she doesn't feel like the problem. She feels like she's standing up for her view.
I understand, mm-hmm. And it's perfectly legitimate, but Chris has got to face the reality that you need to win national elections in order to prevail. In fact, Republicans dominated our politics for a good long while. They won elections. Their ideas were dominant. We ran into trouble, all kinds of economic troubles and foreign policy troubles, and a majority of the country said, no, we want to go in a different direction. And virtually everything Obama has proposed is what he said he would do during the campaign. Yes, there are some honest differences between people, but on top of that, we have some fundamental structural and political problems that are preventing elections from having the kind of consequences they should in policymaking.
Well, let's look at those. I mean, but first, Larry, maybe I'll come to you. I mean, Tom says to Chris in Buffalo, you've got to win elections if you want to steer the boat. But if Republicans think that saying no in every way they can is the way to stop policies they don't like and maybe win elections next time, is that so wrong?
No. I mean, Chris doesn't, you know, cease being a citizen with a point of view just because her candidates didn't win in 2008. And, you know, Mr. Boehner and his colleagues in Congress also have a role to play. It's not a straight parliamentary system where the majority gets to work its will because it happened to carry the day unfettered by minority party participation. That said, most Americans don't have an explicitly ideological approach to politics. They're not extreme liberals or extreme conservatives. They're in the middle, and to a large extent, they want the government to respond to real problems that they perceive in their everyday life. And that interest, that set of preferences, doesn't seem to be registering now on Capitol Hill.
Tom, what's the structural challenge that you would see here? Some way the structure might be changed to get out of this box?
Yeah. First of all, I would argue that, in fact, while Democrats had moved left in the 60s and 70s, after Bill Clinton repositioned them in the center, you're getting an approach to policy that is pretty close to the center. Actually, Democrats are closer to the median voter than Republicans are today, and yet the structural impediments keep them from being able to fully deliver on that.
What are you talking about there, those impediments? Like what?
It really comes down to the Senate and the supermajority requirements. The House has passed at least a dozen bills that haven't yet been taken up by the Senate at all.
But why isn't the answer there, okay, go win half a dozen more Senate seats if that's what you need to do? I mean, Lyndon Johnson had, what, 67 Democrats in the Senate at one point?
Lasted for a brief time, and, he still wouldn't have made it back then because of tremendous differences within the Democratic Party. He put together, say, on the Civil Rights Act, a coalition that had a lot of Republicans with him. But nowadays, the parties are much more distinctive in their ideological views and their aligned media organizations and interest groups, and it makes it much more difficult to engage in that kind of bargaining. But right now, our situation is after Republicans sort of governed for a long while with their ideas, they have moved to the right. Democrats are operating in a center-left position, and frankly, the only way to proceed is as Obama is doing now, and I think he will eventually get health reform this year without a single Republican vote. On financial regulation, he got not a single Republican vote in the House, even though Barney Frank worked closely with Republicans on committee.
How does he get health care without 60 votes?
He doesn't need it anymore because the Senate has already passed a bill with 60 votes. The plan now is that if the House and Senate Democrats can reach an agreement, the House would pass the Senate bill, but there would be a separate bill that encompasses the changes that the two chambers agree on, and that would be part of a budget reconciliation package that requires only a simple majority. That is the process that has been agreed to. There's some difference as to who would begin, the House with a reconciliation package or the Senate, but they're getting close, and if I had to make a prediction, I'd say within a month, there's a good chance that health reform will be signed into law, and we'll look back and say, hey, we've had a pretty productive Congress after all.
Hey, Chris in Buffalo, thanks for your call. Let's go to Vermont, Springfield, Vermont, and Pat. Hi, Pat, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm a litigator, my profession. And one thing that has always struck me as odd here is why we don't go to let people have their filibuster. If that's what they really want, if they want to hold things up, they don't want to compromise, you let them put their mouths where their money is.
Read the phone book, read all night, read all day, go on and on. And why, Pat? Why?
On and on. There's only 100 of them.
Okay, so
we only know of what, 39, 41, somewhere in there that are probably going to do it.
Why would you prefer that? Why do you want to see that?
Well, because that, from a tactical standpoint, I think will alienate more American voters in 10 days than they have ever alienated in 10 years. And I firmly believe that. The last great filibuster, where did Strom Thurmond end up? Defeated. On a lot of different things.
And well, you could be right. It could also be a rallying moment. I don't know. Larry Evans, I don't know the rules here. How's that work? How's it decided whether they actually have to keep talking endlessly or just propose the threat?
Well, back in the 1970s, there were some changes in procedure and practice that made filibusters more palatable. Tom mentioned the two-track system, and there were others. So we don't filibuster now the old-fashioned way, as in, Mr. Smith goes to Washington.
Is it still in the rule book? Could it be insisted on?
Of course. Old-fashioned filibusters. I think the caller makes a great point. One way to get the parties to confront this and to get the people to confront this is to bring it out in the open, and so force the Republicans to make substantive arguments and hash this out. I was struck by the quality of the exchange between President Obama and the House Republicans that was carried on C-SPAN in their recent meeting, and I think more exchanges like that would be a good thing.
Do you think we'll see more of that? There's talk of this sort of question period that they have in the UK Parliament. The president seems to be open to it. Do you think Republicans would be? Do they want that public exchange?
I'm not sure they do. Mr. Boehner's comments coming off that session, I think, made it clear to me that he realized that the president actually looked very good in that exchange, and they may be reluctant to go that direction. But Senate Democrats could force something like that in that chamber.
Let's go to Hampstead, New Hampshire. Rick, you're on the air, Rick.
Yes, I think that, first of all, I consider myself an average American. I consider myself a patriot, and I'm a registered independent.
Okay.
And frankly, I think the case is, as with many Americans, I am sick and tired of the politics getting in the way of any progress in this government. I think we have to realize that government is no longer by the people and for the people. It's by politicians for politicians. And being an independent, I voted for George W. Bush the first time around when I saw how little he was actually accomplishing for the American people. I decided not to vote for him the second time around. And I believe that the answer may lie in realizing that the party system is probably 30 years beyond its time and has degraded into a very much useless machine and left us completely flat-footed in the world economy, the world forum, the world theater. We are completely immobilized in decision-making and need to find a way to get past it. And my question is there a way to undo the political system as it stands now and get it back in the hands of the people? Just because someone like Scott Brown is a Republican and was elected in Massachusetts doesn't mean that's a mandate for Republican policies. And I think that's the mistake in the party system, is that we accept all the policies and have completely lost the ability to sort through and weed through them. I think what the Supreme Court has done recently with the contributions legislation is completely mistaken. I think it's going to send us even further into the abyss.
Rick, we've got that independent point of view right there, and I appreciate your call. Tom Mann, there's an honest American who says, you know, we're flat-footed, we're in trouble, we've got to get something going here, and he is totally disillusioned with the party system. You know, where are we? You've got polarization, and you've got the pragmatism as an old American tradition here, and a lot of Americans sort of gasping to get some of that into gear.
Listen, I sympathize with Rick's feelings, and I agree with his reaction to the Supreme Court decision on Citizens United. But I am not aware of any democracy in the world that has been able to function without some kind of political party system. The reality is that if everyone were independents and had no parties, it would be almost impossible to sort of organize action in a way to be responsive to the electorate and get anything done. Underlying this sort of aversion to politics is a belief that there are consensual solutions to all of our problems, but that's not true. We disagree as a people. We're not all sort of happy centrists. There is no golden mean. Sometimes steps that lean to the left are what's needed. Sometimes steps to the right. In any case, we have differences. We have to organize, channel those differences into a small R Republican system of government. That system's got some structural problems now, and we're trying to cope with them. We have a president who's actually trying very much to accomplish that, and he's having some successes in spite of the unpleasantness of the process and how it looks.
One more call. Cedar Rapids, Iowa. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great program as usual. I guess my point of view is similar to that of your last speaker. I think Obama came to the presidency with the mistake of believing in his power to really persuade people and get them to take a different sort of point of view, just on the basis of his rhetoric and his ideas. And I think he forgot what kind of a system he's in. He's been playing nice guy when, in fact, I think he needs to do what LBJ did, is really persuade people and hold people who disagree with them, hold their feet to the fire. It seems like Obama is now starting to do that, and I think that's ultimately the solution to the problem.
David, thanks for your call. Our time is short here. I apologize. But Larry, what about it? Is it a matter of leadership, Republican, Democrat, Obama? Can leadership get past this, or is leadership, you know, sort of benefiting from the polarization, even paralysis?
Well, leadership within the Congress, to a certain extent, the agendas of the two political parties, at least the Republican Party, would benefit from paralysis. Absolutely, the Republicans in the short term, because people want to see effective government. If they don't get it from the Democrats, they will kick them out and put Republicans in power. That's what happened in 2008. That was a negative retrospective evaluation of the Bush presidency in the Republican years. But at the same time, I think that Tom's point is correct. People tend to have this view that governing is about consensus building, and that conflict is an impediment and unnecessary, when the issues we're dealing with are big and controversial, and people should disagree about them.
Well, Lord knows they do, and maybe nowhere more than right in the Congress, which we will keep watching with your insights in mind. I'm grateful to each of you for being with us this hour. I don't know if we got our, I don't know that we solved this one, but some better understanding anyway, and a good chance for listeners to air their views. Larry Evans at the College of William and Mary, thank you very much for being with us today, Larry.
My pleasure.
And Thomas Mann, Brookings Institution, co-author of The Broken Branch. Tom Mann, great to have you as always. Thanks for joining us.
Wonderful to be with you again, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.